Vaykatra Podcast Conversations for the Curious Essential Knowledge Simplified, your gateway to essential ideas that matter most. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of Vaykatra AI. Welcome, curious minds, to another deep dive. Today, we're wading into a subject that really profoundly impacts how quickly we discover, you know, the next medical breakthrough, how efficiently students learn, and how we, the public, access the knowledge we often actually pay to create.
Yeah.
We are diving deep into the essential work of Peter Suber, open access.
And look, this isn't just some dry policy topic. It addresses a massive modern paradox.
It really does.
We're talking about the fundamental unfairness of the access crisis, or what's often called the cereals crisis.
Think about it. Research gets funded by government grants, maybe university endowments. That means, you know, your tax dollars or maybe philanthropic efforts.
Right. Public money, essentially.
And researchers publish their findings, presumably to advance humanity, right?
Yeah.
But then the articles just vanish, poof, behind these unbelievably expensive paywalls.
Controlled by huge publishing corporations.
Yeah, exactly.
It's a system really trapped in a print era business model. That knowledge gets locked away. It's inaccessible to smaller universities, independent researchers.
And the public, the people who paid for it in the first place.
Precisely. And it slows down everything. I mean, disease research, technological innovation, you name it.
So our mission today is really to understand the transformation that Suber maps out. He proposes a way to use digital technology, which, let's face it, makes sharing knowledge virtually free.
Almost zero cost, yeah.
To tear down those barriers and really accelerate progress, we're looking at how to make public knowledge truly public again.
And Peter Suber is, well, he's uniquely positioned to guide us through this. You might think he came up through publishing or law or policy, but his background is actually in philosophy.
A philosopher. Advocating for policy change, that brings an incredible level of clarity, doesn't it?
It really does.
He's not just like an activist venting frustration. He's applying this deep, logical, ethical rigor to take apart a broken system piece by piece.
Absolutely. And that rigor, it transitioned into really powerful policy work. He moved from his academic role to become the director of the Harvard Open Access Project.
Oh, wow.
And he was really instrumental in shaping the early movement through the Spark Open Access newsletter. Very influential.
So that duality makes his perspective so distinct. He's an academic insider. He gets the important parts of scholarly communication, peer review, clarity, prestige, all that stuff.
Sure, these essential.
But he's also this unwavering reformer who just believes that the primary goal is the public good.
Yeah.
He really is the perfect guide to understanding both the theoretical why and the practical how of open access.
Okay, so let's turn to the book itself, Open Access.
Great.
Suber wrote it to be, well, the definitive guide. It's designed to demystify the whole movement for pretty much everyone.
Yeah.
Researchers, librarians, policymakers.
Even just curious citizens, right?
Exactly. Anyone interested?
And what's great about it, I think, is the tone. It's not a polemic. It's not shouting. It's just a calm, meticulously reasoned explanation and defense of the concept.
Right.
So what's his central premise? If you had to boil it down to, say, 2 or 3 points.
Okay. The core message is pretty simple, really. Open access is the, well, inevitable and achievable solution to that cereals crisis we talked about.
Okay. Inevitable because of technology.
Exactly. Since knowledge can be digitally shared at basically zero marginal cost, the old subscription model is just fundamentally obsolete. It doesn't make sense anymore.
Right.
Then he spends a lot of time addressing all the common fears and misconceptions. He systematically takes apart worries about, you know, quality control, financial sustainability, and the really big one, copyright.
Yes. Copyright always comes up.
Always. And third, critically, he provides a comprehensive roadmap for how to actually do it. This isn't just theory.
Right.
It covers the technical bits, the legal tools, the economic models, the social shifts, everything needed to make OA the default way we share research.
Okay, let's unpack that core definition from chapter one, because I think this is where a lot of people might get tripped up. We think open access just means free online.
Mm-hmm.
But Suber adds a really critical dimension, doesn't he?
He does. He defines open access literature as being digital, online, free of charge, and this is the key, part free of most copyright and licensing restrictions.
That's part. Okay.
That's the kicker. He draws this vital distinction between gratis OA and libre OA.
Gratis versus libre. Okay, so gratis is what most people think of. Like, I can read the PDF for free.
Exactly. Free to read. No price barrier.
Yeah.
Which is good. But libre, it comes from the word for freedom. That's the ultimate goal.
And what does libre add?
It means the work is free to read and free to reuse, copy, translate, even mine for data.
Wow.
As long as you give attribution, you credit the author.
Yeah.
So gratis is nice for one person reading one article.
Sure.
But Libre is absolutely essential for accelerating knowledge on a large scale.
That's the real transformative power then, right? It's not just about making copies for your class. It's about being able to, say, feed millions of medical articles into an AI.
Precisely.
To find new drug targets, something you just can't do if they're only gratis OA stuck behind restrictive terms.
Exactly right. Libre OA enables that kind of data aggregation, the computational research that simply cannot happen when content is fenced off, even if it's free to read.
Okay, so how do we start building this Libre world? Suber maps out the two main paths, green and gold. Complementary paths, he says?
Yeah, we work together. So the green road or OA via repositories, that's the self-archiving route.
Self-archiving?
Yeah. The author gets their article peer-reviewed, accepted by a journal, all the usual stuff. But then instead of relying only on the publisher's version, they deposit a version of that paper. Often it's the final peer-reviewed manuscript, the author's accepted version, into an open repository.
Okay, so like an online archive.
Exactly. These can be institutional, you know, run by Harvard or MIT.
You mentioned those.
Or they can be discipline specific.
Yeah.
Like the famous ArcSOR for physics math folks.
Gotcha. And that's usually free for the author, right? The green route?
Generally, yes.
Yeah.
For the author, green OA is usually free to implement, which is a big plus.
Okay. And the other road, gold.
Then you have the gold road, or OA, via journals. This means publishing immediately in a journal that is itself entirely open access.
Right. Now, this is where people immediately think of costs, the article processing charges or APCs.
Yep. That's often the sticking point people raise.
Isn't the APC model just swapping one paywall for another? Instead of readers paying, the author pays. Doesn't that create a whole new problem for researchers, maybe at smaller schools, less funding?
That is a central and honestly a very fair critique, and Suber tackles it directly.
Okay.
He confirms, yes, APCs are one common model. The author or their funder pays the publication costs up front. But, and this is crucial, he stresses there are only one model for gold OA.
Ah, okay. So not all gold journals charge these APCs.
Not at all. Many high-quality gold journals are funded differently. They might be subsidized by scholarly societies or governments or university libraries.
Interesting.
And they charge no APCs whatsoever. The goal isn't just one model, it's having a diversity of sustainable funding mechanisms for open journals.
Right, that makes sense. Okay, let's shift to what I think is maybe the number one concern Suber had to overcome, the legal roadblock, copyright.
The big one.
People just assume if you make something open, you must be violating copyright somehow. How does he take that fear apart?
Well, he shows that OA doesn't violate copyright at all. It actually operates within copyright law.
How so?
See, copyright starts as a bundle of rights held by the author. Open access is simply the author choosing to grant broad public use rights in advance using their copyright to do so.
Okay, so they're giving permission proactively.
Exactly. They consent to openness. The key tool here is often the Creative Commons, CC license.
Ah, I've seen those, CC BY and things like that.
Precisely. CC BY is a common one. Suber champions. It allows maximum reuse, copying, sharing, adapting, as long as the original author is properly credited. It flips the script from all rights reserved to some rights reserved.
Specifically the right to share.
Right. And this distinction is absolutely vital for making OA work legally. His insight here is really powerful. OA is about using copyright law as a tool for openness, not somehow defying the law.
That's a great way to put it. And since we're on legal tools, we have to talk about something really practical Suber highlights for researchers. The Ocker Addendum.
Oh yeah, the addendum. Very important.
What is that and why is it so powerful for an individual researcher?
Okay, so an author addendum is basically a short, pre-written, legally sound note. A researcher attaches this note to the standard publishing agreement before they sign it.
Okay.
And this note modifies the contract terms. It explicitly says, I, the author, retain the right to self-archive my work in an open repository. It guarantees their right to pursue Green OA, even if the publisher's standard contract tries to restrict it.
Wow. So it's like a little legal lever for the author.
Exactly. It's a way for an individual researcher to proactively take back control over how their own work is shared.
That really does shift the power back towards the creator, which feels like exactly what the system needs. Okay, now, let's talk money. Chapter 7, the economics. If the reader isn't paying via subscriptions, What's Suber's argument? How does this work financially?
Right. The goal isn't to pretend publishing is free. Editing, managing peer review, hosting online, these are real services with real costs.
Sure.
The goal, Suber argues, is to redirect the money already in the system more efficiently. We shift from paying these endless access tolls, those painful escalating subscription fees universities pay.
Which are huge budgets, by the way.
Massive budgets.
Right.
We shift from paying those tolls to paying for the publication services up front when the article is published.
And his argument is that this shift could actually reduce the overall cost to the system.
Potentially, yes. Because universities stop paying redundant subscription fees for overlapping content across thousands of journals. We're already paying enough, maybe more than enough, for scholarly publishing. We're just allocating the funds badly in a way that restricts access.
We're paying for walls instead of dissemination.
That's a good way to put it. And we have solid proof that policy changes can drive this shift. Suber uses the example of the NIH public access policy in the U.S.
Right, the National Institutes of Health. What did that do?
That policy mandated that all research funded by the NIH had to be made openly accessible in PubMed Central, their repository, within 12 months of publication.
Then the result?
A dramatic increase in the amount of open medical research. Suddenly, doctors, patients, researchers worldwide could access this vital information. It proved that powerful funders can compel change and align research sharing with the public benefit.
So policy works when it's implemented seriously.
It absolutely can.
Okay, let's zoom out a bit. Let's talk about three core themes that really highlight why this matters so much to you listening now. The first seems to be the moral and practical imperative.
Yeah, this goes right back to Suber's philosophical roots. Publicly funded research, it's a public good, period.
Full stop, yeah.
Locking it away isn't just ethically questionable. It actively harms society. It slows down medical breakthroughs. It slows down education. It slows down innovation. If you, the public, paid for the research, you should be able to read it and use it. It's almost that simple.
Okay, theme number two, really important for convincing people. Quality is independent of access.
Yes.
Right.
Suber works really hard to disconnect the business model from the standards of peer review.
Because people assume OA means low quality, right? If it's free, it must be bad.
Exactly that prejudice. But it's just not true. Prestigious high-impact OA journals exist. Think of the Public Library of Science, PLOS journals, for example.
Oh, very well respected.
They uphold rigorous, sometimes even stricter, peer review standards than traditional journals. OA is a threat to the subscription business model, not a threat to quality control. The two are separate issues.
That's a crucial distinction. Okay, and the third theme.
Empowerment of the academic community.
Yeah.
By using tools like those Creative Commons licenses we talked about, or the author addenda, researchers can actually retain meaningful control over their own intellectual work. It allows them to act in their own best interest, which is usually maximum readership and impact, and that interest perfectly aligns with the public interest. It shifts power away from legacy publishers back to the creators and the institutions that support them.
That idea of empowerment really resonates. Suber's background in philosophy definitely shines through in his ability to distill these complex policy issues into really memorable, concise statements. Maybe we can share a few of those key ideas.
Absolutely. One that really highlights the agency of the academic community is open access is not a favor that we ask from publishers. It's something we can provide for ourselves.
Ooh, I like that. That's empowering.
Isn't it? It's a reminder to researchers, librarians, universities. You have the power, you have the tools to change the system. You don't have to wait for the big publishers to decide to be benevolent. You are the creators. You hold the key.
Okay, what's another one? Maybe about the copyright issue.
Right. This one reframes that whole debate. The question is not whether open access violates copyright law, but how to use copyright law to enable open access.
Ah, that's the core legal strategy right there.
Exactly. It turns copyright from this big scary monster, this obstacle, into a flexible tool. It paves the way for practical solutions like Creative Commons. It's about making the law work for openness.
Very neat. Okay, so putting this all together, how can people listening apply this knowledge, like, right now?
Well, for different people, it means different things.
If you're, say, a student or an educator.
Knowing about OA means you can legally find and use high-quality articles, data, images for your course materials. Think open educational resources, OERs.
Right, which makes education more affordable and often richer, right? No legal worries about sharing.
Exactly. And if you're just a member of the general public, knowing where to look, like PubMed Central for health research, or institutional repositories, means you can actually access cutting-edge research.
Maybe research you helped fund.
To inform your own health decisions, or maybe conversations with your doctor, or even just to understand the world better.
Or spark a local innovation. Yeah.
And what about for the researchers listening? What's the immediate takeaway?
For researchers, start using those author addenda. Seriously, you can find templates easily online. Groups like Spark offer them.
Okay.
Attaching that simple, legally sound document to your publishing contract is huge. It guarantees you retain the right to self-archive via the green route. It ensures your work reaches more people, which usually means more citations and more impact for you.
This seems like a no-brainer for researchers wanting impact.
It really should be standard practice.
Yeah.
And for, say, university administrators or librarians.
What's the takeaway for them? Suber's economic arguments give you the evidence, the ammunition, to advocate within your institution. Argue for shifting funds away from those incredibly expensive, restrictive subscription packages.
The big deals.
The big deals, exactly. And shifting that money towards supporting innovative Gold OA publishing platforms, or maybe bolstering your own institutional repository to support Green OA, making OA the easy default path.
So stepping back from the details, what surprised you most or what felt most profound about Suber's work when you revisited it?
You know, what struck me this time was the sense of inevitability he frames. He argues the problem isn't really about malicious publishers per se. It's more a dysfunctional system, a system trapped by its own history, by these legacy print era business models. And once you grasp the technological reality that digital sharing is essentially free, the change towards openness feels not just desirable, but kind of unstoppable.
Provided the academic community takes action.
Provided the community acts, yes, it requires effort, but the logic is overwhelming.
Yeah, and for me, the most valuable lesson, I think, is that open access isn't just a policy tweak. It's a real paradigm shift.
How so?
It's moving from viewing knowledge primarily as a commodity, something to be owned and hoarded and sold, towards seeing it fundamentally as a public good, something that achieves its maximum value only when it's shared as widely as possible. And Suber's work, it empowers every single person, reader, researcher, funder, citizen, to be an agent of that change.
It really is the definitive guide. If you want to understand this massive ongoing transformation in how we create and share knowledge, Suber's open access is the place to start.
A powerful framework for a more open future. See you next time with another remarkable thinker, another powerful book, and another idea that has shaped our world. This audio summary is brought to you by Akatra Foundation.